Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Today's program is co-sponsored by the Asia Society of Northern California. I'm Dr. Gail Lapidus, Senior Fellow Emerita at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University, and I will be your chair and moderator for today's program. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. And it is now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Sarah Chase, former NPR correspondent and author of the new book on post-Taliban Afghanistan, entitled The Punishment of Virtue. The Commonwealth Club could not possibly have chosen a more appropriate speaker on a more timely topic. The deteriorating situation in Afghanistan today and the reemergence of Taliban influence urgently demand a reexamination of the whole course of events that made the war there appear to be yet another example of a squandered victory. Her fascinating book, a firsthand account of her experiences on the ground in Afghanistan, draws on exceptional familiarity with Afghan society and politics and an extraordinary network of contacts with Afghan leaders, local elites, tribal groups, as well as with U.S. military and diplomatic circles, which she acquired during the 4 years she spent on the ground there. Arriving in Afghanistan from Pakistan in October 1991, shortly after the post-9/11 U.S. military intervention, Sarah Chase came exceptionally well-equipped to cover the Afghan scene. She had earlier done some graduate work in history and Middle Eastern studies at Harvard University. She had served at the Peace Corps in Morocco. She then had a number of years of experience as a war correspondent in other conflict regions, from the Balkans, where she won an award with others on the NPR team for her coverage of the Kosovo War, to North Africa, to the Middle East, Lebanon, Israel, and Palestine. She developed over the years of her time in Afghanistan an intimate familiarity, first as an NPR correspondent from Kandahar, itself an important choice of venue because Kandahar was the heartland of Taliban influence, and it was rarely covered by the many correspondents who congregated in Kabul. And she then moved, sort of left journalism, to become a civil society activist seeking to help rebuild post-conflict Afghanistan. She became involved in launching a village-level cooperative in the former Taliban stronghold of Kandahar in an effort to discourage opium production by helping farmers earn a decent livelihood. Under her leadership, Afghans for Civil Society, a nonprofit organization founded by Kayum Karzai, rebuilt a village destroyed during the anti-Taliban conflict, organized successful income-generating projects for Kandahar women, launched a popular radio station, conducted a number of policy studies. She has published very widely, spoken very widely, and for those of you who delve into the book, which is on display outside afterwards, I think you'll find it an utterly fascinating and eminently readable account. So please join me in welcoming Sarah Chase.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming out. I know that this is what the Commonwealth Club is about, but I still find it a sign that the United States has not yet gone down the tubes, that people are actually willing to take an hour or so in the middle of their very busy days and listen to somebody talk. It's a very, I'm very moved. As Gail just let you know, I used to be a journalist and then I stayed behind. And it's not just that I loved Afghanistan, although that is the case in a complicated kind of way. And it's not just that I wanted to, you know, like shut up already and do something, although that was also the case. It was also that this was right after 9/11. And To me, that was this century's equivalent of the assassination of the Archduke, basically, that launched the First World War and, in my view, launched the 20th century. This was the defining, I believe, will be seen as the defining event of the 21st century. It was like the plate tectonics of history were shifting, and I think they still are. And my feeling then, as I think a lot of other people's feeling was, is that there was a crossroads that was in front of us as a nation, and given our impact internationally, given the weight that the United States does have internationally, it was a crossroads for a lot of the world. And one possibility, one of the paths that we could take could be summed up by these words that we heard shortly after 9/11, with us or against us. And I rush to add that I think that's a pretty natural reaction among people who are attacked. You know, I mean, our brothers and sisters were killed and their friends and family, our friends and families were suffering after because of 9/11. But I felt even then and still do now that with us or against us is not a very sophisticated reaction. It's not a very civilized one, actually. And we were being also told about a clash of civilizations. And I guess I don't really believe in clash of civilizations. I don't believe that we're in some epic fight to the death, Islam versus the West, if there even were such a thing as those two entities. And I guess I see and saw the fight a little bit differently, as one between those on either side of that divide, Islam and the West, or other divides, who believe in with us or against us thinking. That's one team. And the other team are the people who believe that we are in an interconnected world full of rich and diverse and flawed civilizations that have a lot to learn from and teach each other. And it seemed to me that that's a fight between those two visions of the world that we're in right now. That is a fight that's worth fighting and worth taking risks for. It's sort of like our generation's version of the Spanish Civil War or, you know. And so it seemed to me that Afghanistan and Kandahar in particular was the front line in this different, I would say, conflict, even if it's a conflict of ideas. So that's really why I stayed in Kandahar. And the first thing I did was run this maverick NGO, non-governmental organization, that had been founded by President Karzai's older brother. And this happened because I had dinner with President Karzai's uncle, who had been one of my super, super background sources on not intelligence, but on the cultural context in which a lot of events that were otherwise difficult to decipher were taking place. So I would go during the bombing campaign against the Taliban regime, and in particular during the kind of hiatus that I'm not sure if you guys remember, but the Kabul fell in November of 2001, and you know, we kind of thought that we had gained the country because that was the capital of the country and everything. And similarly, although not as spectacularly as the case with Iraq, you know, capturing the capital didn't mean that we had captured the country. So there was 3 weeks of hiatus before the Taliban finally fell. And Uncle Aziz really was, I would go and sit in his garden, and he was very helpful in explaining a lot of the traditional styles of dispute resolution and negotiated settlement of conflicts and things like that that are deeply ingrained in Pashtun society. And so I had dinner with him, and I'm walking out the door, and the guy says, "Wouldn't you come back and help us?" And I said, "Yes," before I even registered the question. So he passes me on to his other nephew, Kayyum Karzai's older, President Hamid Karzai's older brother, Kayyum, who has lived in the United States for decades on the East Coast. And what was interesting about that, the reason I drag you through this story, is that we were not constrained, not having a long-standing professional background in the international development or aid biz, and it is a biz, we were not constrained by a lot of the rather rigid boundaries between different types of action that constrains most of that community. And so we found ourselves mixing direct action on the ground with policy communication. I mean, I knew immediately that the main problem facing the post-Taliban period in Afghanistan was going to be warlordism, because I had watched a warlord, as I was reporting, I had watched a warlord take Kandahar by force, not from the Taliban, who were already gone, but from President Karzai's choice for who was going to be governor of the province. So I knew there is something going on here that we're not seeing. In fact, U.S. troops had egged this guy on to take Kandahar from the other guy that U.S. troops were backing, and who was, in fact, by this time, president of the country. So I had a hard time making that one compute, and I thought that if this is how we're starting this vitally important, I don't want to say experiment in nation building, but for lack of a better term, if this is how we're starting it, and the eyes of the world were riveted on us there in Afghanistan, we've kind of forgotten that now because Iraq has blown it out of the water. But at that time, this was where a lot of the world was going to come down on the clash of civilizations, was going to be determined by how we did in Afghanistan. So I went into this with a notion that this was going to be a big issue. I underestimated the degree to which other people would agree with me. I mean, I thought this was going to be, everyone was going to gang up on the warlords and we would get rid of them within 6 months. Well, so much for those illusions. But in any case, it turns out to be a lot easier to speak to a group of people like you about warlordism when it's your tractor that got held up at gunpoint by the governor's thugs when we were rebuilding a village that had been destroyed in the American bombing. So I needed some rocks for the foundations of these mud brick houses that were rubble and that, you know, whose inhabitants were not Al-Qaeda or Taliban, although it was probably okay that, meaning not an error, that their village had been destroyed because it was right next to the airport and that was Al-Qaeda's last stand. And by then the villagers were, you know, there was a lot of tonnage coming down out of the sky at them. And so they took off. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if Al-Qaeda people were using that village as, you know, holed up in it. However, the villagers were not Al-Qaeda people, and it seemed to me that they deserved to come back to, you know, houses. So we gathered money actually from people like you. The U.S. government, USAID, the military was not interested in rebuilding private property. And so I addressed a group of people in the East Coast in Concord, Massachusetts, which is a symbolic town where our own experiment in democracy was launched. And the people were really excited about this. And so we gathered the money. And then the problem is that the governor and his thugs hold us up at gunpoint and say, no, all the stone in Kandahar province belongs to the governor. Now, I wish I had visuals, which I left, unfortunately, on a Midwest Express airplane. Take my word for it, just about the only thing there's a lot of in Kandahar is rocks. and so seeing how a public official basically pillages the public property of his province for personal gain, and having an effort to provide shelter to his constituents be obstructed by this kind of governance made it easier for me to speak out about this issue. And that's why I still think that our mixture of policy communication and concrete action wasn't so dumb. And, you know, as this story kind of demonstrates, what I started seeing from the very beginning was that governance, that democracy, in the complex sense of the word, was really taking a backseat to the so-called war on terror. Because, you know, when I would say to American officials, you know, you guys have to get untangled from this warlord because he's tying you around his little finger and he's abusing his citizens. And I would hear, well, you know what? He's got this great militia and we're using him for the war on terror. Or, you know, because he has armed people, he's keeping a lid on the security situation. Well, I understood that the security situation, as Afghans were experiencing it, was being made worse by this guy, because Afghans were having, you know, this guy's thugs were shaking them down. They were, you know, arresting them and holding them for ransom and pushing them around and things like that. So when you talk to Afghans about what their security concerns were, they were more worried about what the government was doing to them than what any incipient Taliban, insurgents were doing, although that has changed. But I'll get into that in a second. So here's what happened. We had no plan. And I know that, again, I kind of feel like, you know, we got here first. We Afghan crowd got here first. But Iraq is such a more massive example of the same problems that it's almost embarrassing to me to bring this up to you. But, you know, the notion somehow was that you decapitate a regime and all of a sudden a fully blown democracy is gonna rise up from the roots all by itself. And there's no notion about what kinds of people and behavior need to be nurtured in order to have, particularly in a society that, you know, in the case of Iraq has been through a pretty rigid dictatorial situation, and in the case of Afghanistan, has been through 30 years of war. It's a society in post-traumatic stress disorder. The entire society is suffering post-traumatic stress disorder. Military proxies become government officials. I can understand why in the immediate wake of 9/11, when we've got a military campaign to run, we might want to recruit some people on a military basis who, you know, in a hurry, who might not be the most savory of allies or whatever. But when you don't have a plan for the civilian after effects of a military campaign, then those military, and when you don't have any civilians on the ground, I mean, frankly, the first 6 months of post-Taliban Afghanistan, there was basically no U.S. civilian presence. There was an embassy without an ambassador. The embassy had staff on two-week rotations because they had to share bathrooms, and so it was considered too much of a hardship to have people in a place where they had to share the shower with several other people for more than 2 weeks. We had one person who spoke a local language, and he had the record for the length of rotation, which was 6 weeks. And so in this vacuum, it ends up being the military that is conducting U.S. foreign policy. And unfortunately, our military, you know, I'm not saying they're less qualified individuals. I think that the behavior of our military, a number of our military officers in Iraq, as we can all read in Fiasco, which I urge you to read after you've read my book, goes to show that, you know, they really know what they're talking about. And I, frankly, am very grateful to the judge advocate generals who are right now standing up and fighting in Washington for what I consider to be our national honor in terms of how we treat detainees and how we try people who are gathered up in these sorts of operations. But overall, our military is trained to fight battles. It is not trained to conduct diplomacy and political restructuring of a country. So what they tend to do, just by default, the people who were the military proxies became political powers. And they became political powers on a local level where the rubber hits the road, and with a tremendous advantage over their fellow citizens of U.S. backing, U.S. uniforms. Their militias were running around in U.S. combat fatigues, which to Afghans means that whatever they do is part of U.S. policy. That's what that body language means. And these guys had weaponry that we were providing them and lots of money. And so that is kind of, you know, you can't then ask a population to rein these people in when you've given these local strongmen such incredible advantage. And so what they did do was to prey upon their countrymen. And, you know, so as I said a few minutes ago, I was told at the time when I start jumping up and down about people like this warlord governor of Kandahar, I'm told, yeah, we'll worry about governance later. Well, now is later. And here's what we have. We've got the famous Afghan National Army, which we're the United States is very proud of having stood up, as it were. The ones who are down in Kandahar don't speak the local language. They speak Persian, which is the language of northern and western Afghanistan. And down in the southern eastern half, we speak Pashto. So I even get offended when I'm stopped at a checkpoint and the soldier who stops me can't understand when I'm telling him where I'm going in Pashto, which is the local language. They shake people down. They push people around. When they've been deployed in the areas just outside of Kandahar, where there's a lot of fighting right now, they're deployed, you know, to have checkpoints, and they're systematically shaking down everybody that they stop and search for whatever valuables they might happen to be carrying with them. We have things like, I run a cooperative now, as Gail mentioned, and we make soap, and you can buy some of our soap at Body Time in Berkeley, and I think there's a San Francisco shop too. Or at least you can get online to buy some soap futures, because it's great stuff, and lots of people want it, which is wonderful. But we needed to register ourselves as a cooperative with the Department of Agriculture, and to do this, first of all, it took us 7 months to accomplish this task because basically the administration doesn't function unless it's greased in various ways, which is something that people remember was not the case under the Taliban. People remember that if you needed to get a license plate for your car or something like that, you got it in 3 days and you didn't have to cough up, you know, incentives to five different people along the way. So we finally get the paperwork done. And what we have to do to get the final stamp on the final page of this thing is deposit some money in the National Bank, which is our money, but it's a way of making sure that the cooperative has financial assets that it can distribute to its members if they need it and stuff like that. So we do this thing, and I'm trying to have my Afghan members really running the show here. And so our treasurer comes back and says, Sarah, you know what? He wants a bribe. He wants a 500 Afghani bribe, which is about $10. And, you know, I can't get him to write a receipt for it. And I said, okay, this is how this sort of works. The amount of money that you don't get a receipt for is the... So I go back and we argue with the guy and we go in to see the guy's superior. And I say, look, I'd be happy to give him the 500 Afghanis, but I have a board of directors to report to and I need to provide, you know, accounts. So the supervisor agrees. She's absolutely right. And you can see the guy, damn, you know. And we go back to his desk and he has to fill out 5 different little slips of paper to get this transaction done. And they're in triplicate, so they are receipts for the various different bits of money that we're depositing. And then he wants 20 Afghanis per slip of paper that he's filled out. And I say, absolutely, here's 100 Afghanis, but I need a receipt for it. I can't give you a receipt. I put the money back in my pocket. And he says he's not going to complete our paperwork until tomorrow morning. Now, I don't know how physiologically this next thing happened, but next thing I know, I'm sitting on the guy's desk, cross-legged, amidst his papers, and I cross my arms and I say, okay, then I'm not leaving here until tomorrow morning. And we got our paperwork completed. But this is something I can get away with, which Afghans can't. Or don't feel that they can. And ironically, there are a lot of counterintuitive things in my experience and in what I'll be telling you for the rest of our hour, which is coming to a close already. I'm actually safer in Kandahar than a lot of Afghans are, because I cannot be beaten. I can't be hauled off and stuck in jail by the government. You know, I represent superior force, and that really makes a big difference in that society. And so that's part of why I'm so much of a loudmouth, because in a lot of ways I feel like I'm speaking for a population that that doesn't have the same access and the same ability or feel that it has the same ability to speak out. We also handed them an election, which was, I mean, you know, it made Florida in 2000 look like, you know, a really free and fair exercise. And what was interesting for me in that context was that this was last fall, it was parliamentary elections, and we have the descent of the media, right? You know, no one has been in Afghanistan for the last 2 years, and suddenly everyone shows up, and they showed up about a day or two before the election and did their setup pieces, and then they covered the voting, and then they left. And I could, you know, forgive the European journalists for that, but surely American journalists know by now that the important day in election is not the day the votes are cast, it's the days on which they are counted. And so they forgot that. They left, and there was a 10-day free-for-all in which, you know, ballot boxes were full of ballots that were all written in the same color ink. We had zeros in the counting process that were for sale. I mean, you could basically go up to the counting official and buy an extra zero for your candidate's tally. And, I mean, it was insane. And so I guess, you know, I'm often asked, is it right for us to impose democracy on people who may not be ready for it or may not want it? And my answer to that is, okay, maybe we are bringing American democracy as we currently experience it to places like Afghanistan and Iraq, but I don't believe that's what we have to offer as a nation. You know, I think this is, again, our challenge as a country right now. And so just two brief more points, and then I want to throw it open to a conversation. But what I'd like you guys to understand is that the Taliban resurgence that you're reading about isn't about ideology. It's not about, you know, we're against the unbelievers and things like that. It's not against Western civilization or anything like that. I live there. I am the most well-known and unprotected American in Kandahar, and knock wood, I'm still alive to stand here and tell you about it, and I still live there, and I don't have guards, and I don't have barbed wire, and I don't, you know. What this is about is governance. People in Afghanistan, in southern Afghanistan, have been waiting for the last 5 years for something that they thought we were the champions of, which is, let's set the word democracy aside because it's so loaded, but let's just say good governance, accountable governance. What people are looking for is a lot, I mean, the women's issue aside, which is a big issue, but that aside, what I'm hearing from people, what they want from their government is what we want from ours. You know, they want decent infrastructure, they want, let's have some doctors that at least have been through a medical qualifying exam so they're not, I mean, I could set up as a doctor right now in Kandahar and nobody would stop me. So they're prescribing medicine that's often poisoning people. They want, you know, schools for their girls as well as their boys. Not all of them, but most of them do. And we're talking Kandahar, the home base of the Taliban. And they want some kind of substantive participation in their collective destiny. And I use that terminology on purpose because we tend to confuse process with substance of democracy. We tend to say, oh, a group or a country has held elections, therefore it's democratic. It turns out that there are lots of ways of giving us, you know, citizens a substantive say in their collective destiny that don't necessarily, you know, that may have to do with more consensus building types of processes than the one that we've settled on here. And so what I see happening is not an indigenous uprising like Iraq. This Taliban resurgence, and this is an issue we can get into in our conversation, is definitely being concocted across the border in Pakistan. There is absolutely no doubt in my mind about that. However, when you've got people who are finding that their own government is just as hostile to them as the Taliban are, I mean, I've got people saying to me, you know, the Taliban won't leave us alone at night, meaning prey upon us at night, ask us for food, ask us for a place to stay, you know, shake us down for material support, and then the government shakes us down in the daytime for material support. It's like, I had someone tell me, we feel like we're trying to balance on two watermelons. That's a local proverb. So when you're in that kind of a situation, and 20 people with guns show up and say, give us some food, and you've got a family and land that, you know, I mean, you're probably going to do that. And so there's a lot of very, very practical you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Very practical kind of negotiating of how to find a path through these opposing forces that ordinary people find both of them to be hostile to their interest. That's what really accounts for the Taliban insurgency. And if we had focused, my judgment is that if we had thought about governance and really focused on governance from day one in this thing, you would not have a Taliban insurgence right now because the Afghan population wouldn't have put up with it. And the last thing that I would just like to sort of underscore is a lot of what this book of mine, and this has been a bit of a policy talk, but it is, and there are some pretty heartbreaking things in this book, but there's some humor in it too. So believe me, it's not a snooze to read. But I think that one of the main points I try to convey without hammering on it, I hope, is that it has to do with knowledge, and it has to do back to this issue with this issue of us versus them. I think that this is about getting close enough to people who seem different from us, however you choose to define us, to understand their perspective. That's critical, and it's critical not only in international policy, but I also think that it's critical as we look around at our own family here in the United States. My niece works for the mayor of Boston, and I learn when I get back here that the murder rate among young people in the streets of downtown, of basically inner city Boston, is just about as high as the murder rate among Canadian soldiers in Kandahar. And it turns out that lots of people in Boston don't know that, because they're not getting closer. They consider these kids to be them in one way or another. They're a different color. They have a different, you know, economic background, a different educational background. And so they don't exist, or they're them in one way or another. And I think we need to work on, I know I'm speaking to the converted here, but we need to work very hard on reducing these barriers between us and them, however we define those two teams. Thank you very much for being here, and I think we're going to make it into a conversation quickly. So don't even clap. That's going to take up time.
Our thanks to Sarah Chase, former NPR correspondent and author of the new book on post-Taliban Afghanistan called The Punishment of Virtue. There's one set of questions that ask if you could talk a little bit further about the whole role of Pakistan. You have talked in some of your remarks and at greater length in the book about the fact that not only did Pakistan play a critical role in the original support for the Taliban, but that it continues to play a very negative role in Afghanistan today. And there's it poses an enormous problem for American policy, which is very follows a double track in relation to Pakistan. Would you address that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm going to speak in shorthand, which means I'm going to use the word Pakistan or the Pakistani government. Bear with me. Pakistan is a diverse, vibrant country full of very, you know, diverse people and stuff like that who may not, doubtless do not all approve of all of the actions of their government. But bear with me while I use the shorthand. The Pakistani government, and in particular the military and military intelligence establishment, has pursued a really consistent regional policy for the last 30 years, which has entailed manipulating religious extremism for a regional political agenda. And that happened during the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in the 1980s. And basically, because of the Cold War situation of the day, we, the United States, couldn't support resistance factions directly because that might get us into a nuclear exchange with the Soviet Union. So we gave our $500 million, quarter of $1 billion a year for 10 years. We gave that money to Pakistan, which then chose which factions to dole it out to, and chose one in particular, which was a kind of precursor to the Taliban, and the most extremist of the seven factions that were around. And I have to say that U.S. policy also kind of thought that religious ideology was the greatest possible antidote to communism, which was officially atheistic. So we were kind of supported this distribution of the money. What was very interesting was that when the Soviets pulled out in 1989, Afghanistan was not at all interested in having an extremist government. And so this guy, whose name was Gulbuddin Hikmatyar, was incapable, in spite of having huge backing from the Pakistani government, was incapable of taking over the country. What happens then is about 5 years of one of the most revolting, unpredictable, chaotic, bloody civil conflicts, you know, that the world saw at that time. And at the end of 5 years of that, then, I mean, the Pakistani government becomes pretty aware that this is not going to work, and so they basically ginned up the Taliban regime or the Taliban movement. And 5 years of chaos later, Afghanistan was pretty much ready for anything that would look like law and order rather than what they had experienced for the previous 5 years. And that's what really explains why the Taliban were able to get, you know, capture such and so easily, in the south anyway, a foothold on the country. Now, I believe that Pakistan's objective is ideally to control Afghanistan. It's just a straight kind of territorial and political, regional. It's regional politics. They're looking at India. India is a big, rich, powerful country, and Pakistan looks pretty small. And I think they're looking for what's called strategic depth. And so ideally they control the country, which basically they did under the Taliban. Kandahar's telephone exchange, for example, had a Pakistani country code and a Balochistan area code. So that's a pretty vivid demonstration of how Pakistan felt about that part of the world. The whole Afghan economy was basically hitched to the Pakistani economy in a subordinate role. You had Pakistani government was paying people for the roots of pistachio trees. So people would dig up their trees and sell the roots because they needed money at that moment, and that basically decimated one of Afghanistan's, major resources. So in my mind, the notion that Pakistan suddenly on September 12, 2001, reverses this policy is crazy. And what I've seen happening is a very clever double game where the Pakistani government is kind of talking the right game and doing some activities that look good, like, you know, fighting some people up in Waziristan and stuff like that, and turning over an Al-Qaeda operative note. They haven't turned over any high-level Taliban. And these Taliban, they are not in caves or in, you know, isolated places. They are in Quetta, which is the capital of Balochistan province, and they've got apartments there, and they've got vehicles that are provided by the ISI, and they've got weapons authorization cards. I know it. I mean, you know. And so the notion that Pakistan isn't doing enough to combat cross-border insurgency is nonsense. Pakistan is creating and supporting cross-border insurgency, but what's happening is that they're buying us off with a delivery of an Al-Qaeda operative or two every 2 or 3 months. And I don't think we've seen through this. And the result is that Kandaharis are so baffled by this policy that they can only, they have a hard time accounting for incompetence or error or conflicted agendas or anything like that. What they believe is that the United States is in league with the Taliban. And that's really why they're upset with us. Why are the Americans ginning up this insurgency? And the reason they think that is because, you know, in 2003, we gave the Pakistani government $3 billion over a five-year period, and it looks a lot like the situation in the 1980s when we were giving Pakistan money, which it was spending on the anti-Soviet insurgents. Now we're giving Pakistan money, and Pakistan is, you know, the Pakistani government is spending money on these Taliban insurgents. So Kandaharis assume that that's our deliberate policy. I guess I'll stop that there, but it's really, really hard for me to convince them out of that.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program with Sarah Chase, former NPR correspondent and author, who is discussing post-Taliban Afghanistan. Siri, there's another whole cluster of questions about President Karzai. Yeah. Can you say a few words about his background and his role, and in particular, why hasn't he taken a more forceful position in combating the warlords and trying to assert his authority?
This is a tough question for me because I feel like a member of the Karzai family. I mean, it happened totally ad hoc because, you know, I had this interaction with Uncle Aziz, which I told you about, and then he passes me along to Kayyum. And I have spent a lot of time inside the houses, the homes of the Karzai brothers. We have had a lot of conversations about what's going on in Afghanistan. And I have, on a personal level, received nothing but generosity and support from them. And I believe that President Karzai is not a corrupt person himself, but I do believe that he is lacking a little bit of the moral courage that was really required of somebody who was going to pull this off. And to be fair to him, he's got a lot of pressure. You know, as I just described to you earlier, we, the United States, come in, we decapitate the government, you know, we basically remove the government of a country, we install other people armed and financed to a fantastic degree, and then we say, golly, Mr. Karzai, whatever you want to do, you can do it. He has a tendency to read, as most Afghans do, read gestures, read body language, rather than reading what people say. And what he looked around and saw is that, well, the Americans are employing these warlords in their war on terror. How am I going to remove them from power if their, you know, if their tribal militias who are loyal to them are in the employ of the United States? So he would have needed a lot more support from the Americans in order to be able to extricate these people from his government in those early years, 2002, 2003. He would have had to have had an agreement from the American government, oh, we'll sign up a different group of thugs to scour the caves and stuff like that. And he wasn't getting that. As a matter of fact, he tried, and this story is told in this book, he tried to fire six of these guys, of these warlords, in 2003. And he gets, guess what 2003 was? The launching of the Iraq War. So he gets this line of people from Washington and from the embassy and, you know, military commanders and high U.S. officials, civilian officials, telling him, some other time, Mr. Karzai, this is not the moment to, you know, basically create unpredictability, let's say, in Afghanistan. And now, arguably, there are a couple of things he could have done. One was he could have had a better plan for this. Americans don't tend to like things, especially American military people, don't like major operations where when they say, well, what happens if there's this response, and you say, well, there's not going to be this response. That's going to usually give military planners a cold sweat, which is why you'll read in Fiasco that there was a lot of opposition among the military for the way we went into Iraq. And so he didn't really have a very good plan. He didn't have that lined. He didn't have his ducks in a row. And there's another thing you could argue, and which I do argue, is that you've decided to be president of this country. At some point, you have to stand up to the United States government and say, I really appreciate, you know, what you've done for our country, and I really appreciate the fact that I owe my job to you guys, but I am the president of a sovereign country, and this is what I'm going to do. And if you don't want me to do that, then I can always resign. And I just think that he never really took a stand of principle and was not able to take a stand of principle, largely for psychological reasons. I don't think he's that kind of guy. And I think he underestimated the tremendous support that he had from the Afghan people to clean up his government. And so what he's done is really, really disappoint the people who believed in him and who were inspired by him. And what he's been doing is trying to buy off his enemies, and he's been taking his friends for granted. And that's not a very good way to run a country.
Siri, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program with Sarah Chase, former NPR correspondent and author, who is discussing post-Taliban Afghanistan. Siri, there's been another cluster of questions about the whole issue of opium production in Afghanistan. Why is it developing the way it is? What would it take to eradicate it? Why isn't the U.S. government eradicating it? And what alternative forms of livelihood might be available to Afghans?
I love that one because I'm, you know, go buy my soap at Body Time and you will be supporting the effort to compete with opium. It's not quite as simple as, you know, a pound of opium is worth more than a pound of watermelons. There are structural reasons why people get involved in growing poppy. One of them is there's no banking system. So do you have children? That's a personal question. Do you have a son?
Yeah.
You do. Okay. If you were going to marry off your son, it would cost you $5,000 to $10,000 minimum. And this is in the Afghan economy where people make $100 a month maximum, basically. I mean, that's, let's say, $100 to $200 a month maximum. So it's a bride price society. So you would be choosing your son's wife. He wouldn't have any say in the matter. You would go to a lot of other weddings and you would spy out the gals that you were interested in having come into your house, because this is the other thing. You marry off your son and his wife comes to your house, that means you also need to build an extra room onto your house. It is extended family compounds. So this is a major, major financial burden for families. And people can't go to the bank and take out a consumer loan. So they go to the opium trafficker and take out a loan. And then the opium trafficker says, you need to pay me back in opium. And not only that, he values the opium at half the market rate. So it amounts to a 100% interest loan. Now, most of the opium reduction programs that I've seen have been focused on the farmers. And this has the following blowback. Let's say I'm now the Afghan government and you have borrowed money and you have now planted a field of opium to pay that back. I'm the government. I come and dig up your field. Guess what? You still owe that money and you owe it in opium and you're not going to be able to pay it back this year. So you have to pay it back next year at a quarter of the market rate. It means you have to plant double the amount of opium to pay back your debt. So straight eradication programs that don't take this kind of structure into account are really counterproductive. The other reason is that we're in a drought. Afghanistan has a fabulous irrigation. It's not rainfall agriculture. There is not enough rain. Rains come very briefly in the beginning of the growing season. And at best, in rainy years, what you have is snow in the mountains, which melts through the spring and summer and raises the level of the groundwater. But in particular, there are these fabulous underground irrigation channels called karezes, which bring the water down from the mountains and then come up above ground around people's fields. But there's no water in them these days because we're pretty much in, I mean, there were six good solid years of drought, and then there was a year of rain, a year of drought, a year of rain, and this past year was drought. So it's very interesting to me that this has been a big opium year because people then need to water their fields by extracting water from wells, and there's no electricity. So that means you have a water pump which is fired by diesel, which you have to buy. So you're essentially paying for water, and that means you have to take land out of production because you just can't afford to water all your land. And that obliges families, again, to look for, you know, maybe they'd be able to do okay if they could plant fruit and vegetables and some wheat probably on the full extent of their land. But if they've taken half of it out of production, they need a much higher value crop for the land that's remaining. So those are two of the structural reasons. And in my view, there needed to be a lot of work on not just infrastructure, but alternative livelihoods. What I was hearing from villagers was, you need to figure out how to get us more money for our fruit. This is what we really need. This turns out to be way before the Taliban. Kandahar was known for its fruit and still is. It was contributing its tribute to the Sumerian Empire was in grapes. And this is recorded in cuneiform tablets that, you know, from what came to be called Arachosia is the region under the Greeks. It was called Arachosia. The grapes are unbelievable. The pomegranates, you know, we're all, when you get past Iraq and Afghanistan and Lebanon in the front section of the paper, you encounter pomegranates on the front page of your health section, right? So this is the pomegranate capital of the world. They've got apricots, they've got almonds, they've got various botanicals, anise seed, licorice root, all of this stuff is very valuable. So I thought, we don't need to think of a new crop to teach people to grow that's worth a lot of money. What we have to do is figure out how to get more of these crops out to, you know, more buyers. And so I figured, you know, fruit is heavy and perishable, so what can I make it into that's less perishable? And I came up with, you know, natural body care, because there's a big explosion in that stuff too. And so we're making soaps and eventually bath oils and lotions and things like that out of all of this local stuff. And it is so exciting. But what's interesting to me is that it took over a year of fighting with their USAID, our overseas development agency, gave $119 million to an outfit called Chemonix, which is not Halliburton or Bechtel, but sort of the moral equivalent of them. And they've got $119 million to spend on alternative livelihoods projects, exactly the term you just used, in the three southern provinces over a five-year period. And in the first year and a half, they've only managed to get rid of four of those $1 million, three of which they spent on themselves, on their cars and their salaries and their offices and all of this kind of thing. And here we are out there doing alternative livelihoods. We actually contracted with eight farmers. I'm glad we started slow, because now the war has kind of broken out and it's the area that we were working in is pretty difficult. But to grow roses. Now, we didn't do a straight substitution thing. We couldn't offer them enough to be able to do that. But as we expand and as the market, you know, for both our finished products and our production of, let's say, rose oil, which is the essential oil of rose blossoms, as we're able to produce more of that and put it into the commodities market, I'm going to be able to contract with farmers and say, okay, you know, plant 10 acres of roses, but if you join our club, you can't grow poppy. And here's the guarantee. We gave them a guarantee that we're buying their rose blossoms for the next 5 years. And I think that's how you get people off of opium, is you give them some kind of security. You know, the other interesting thing on my way over here in the taxi, I'm talking to my U.S. coordinator, and we're trying to handle the shipping issue. We have 100 kilos of soap that Body Time is dying to get their hands on and sell to you people. And I was sending our stuff out through the Army Post Office, because there's an Army base at the airport. They have taken over the airport, so there's no civilian flights in and out of Kandahar. They found out about this because some nice Canadian journalist mentioned it in an article, and they had a fit, and they threw me against... Somebody knew, but somebody in charge didn't quite know. So they threw me against the wall, practically, and were alternately accusing me of being a terrorist and a drug dealer. And so that was the end of shipping our soap out the Army Post Office. So now I'm working. So then I go to the Afghan Freight Forwarders Union. Well, they only do surface, and we don't quite have enough to send containers of the stuff out yet. So now we're, you know, in this endless conversation with DHL about, you know, can they don't have to ship overnight. We could do the slow boat routine, but could they please cough up a quote for how much it will cost to ship 100 kilos of soap by the slow boat? And it's been over a month, and I haven't gotten a quote out of these people. So these are the kinds of very concrete things that need to be solved in order for, you know, illicit, healthy economy to emerge in southern Afghanistan. And I'm just about as pig-headed and loud-mouthed as anybody can hope to be. And if I'm having this hard of a time, how do we expect Afghan entrepreneurs? And we've got 9 minutes left. I could do, you know, 17 of those 9 minutes on the really concrete and ridiculous difficulties that Afghan entrepreneurs and manufacturers are confronting. So these are some of the things that are getting in the way, and I don't understand why, if this is supposed to be a policy objective of ours, why we can't tackle some of these issues. Is there one more cluster of questions that I can...
Another cluster of questions that focus on the whole question of women in Afghanistan. To what extent have
positive changes taken place? Is there a regression underway? What can you say about the overall situation today?
It's a little bit better. I live in the South. I live in the absolutely worst place in the country for women, and I live in a place where we are metabolizing heavy-duty stuff every single day. I mean, I know that General Richards, who is the British general in charge of the NATO troops who have now taken over for the Americans in Afghanistan, he's great. He's really dynamite. I've met him several times. He's smart. He's interested in learning and all of that stuff. So he's just announced that Panjwayi is now cleared out. But women who work, we are a co-ed cooperative, and the women have their own area, which is shielded, but they interact with the men all the time. They just have a slightly private area where they can, for example, roll up their sleeves if they're shucking pomegranates, which is not really proper to do in Sharia. But they don't cover their faces inside the compound. They interact with the men in the cooperative on a daily basis and in a very friendly and mutually respectful way, which is just fabulous. And, you know, we are small, but in some ways I felt that this would be a more revolutionary thing for us to do than to have a women's program. I mean, here we have men and women working together. The production phases are integrated. So it's like the women do the first phase and the men do the second and third phases and on and on. But they don't tell their neighbors, for example, that they work with me. They tell their neighbors that they are domestic servants in people's houses or that they bake bread in somebody's house or something like that. They don't feel safe telling people that, you know, they work in this kind of environment. They wear their burqas the second they, you know, approach the door. We give them a lift home from work. They come to work by themselves in the morning, but we take them all home. Because, again, public transportation for women is not all that comfortable. But they ask us to drop them off 3 or 4 blocks away from their houses so people don't see the vehicle. We don't have a big, you know, SUV with our name plastered on it. It's a battered, you know, pickup truck, but still being driven by a strange man, and they would rather not have their neighbors comment on this. So there has been some. Girls are still in school in Kandahar, but, you know, there are threats regularly. School personnel get killed regularly, and people, like I said, it's PTSD. These are people who are psychologically traumatized, and it doesn't take a lot to intimidate Afghans, it turns out. And so there was a big scare because there were a lot of night letters. What we call night letters are these pamphlets, you know, saying take your children out of school, boys as well as girls. But in particular girls, and one of the Argonne women did take her girls out of school for 2 or 3 days, and then she got embarrassed, realized that other people were still sending their girls to school, so back they went. But you can feel it. I mean, it feels like, I don't want to end this, we've got 5 minutes left, and I don't want to end on a depressing note, but it does feel as though we're in one of those rooms where the walls are kind of closing in on you. That's what it feels like in Kandahar right now. And the psychological drain of it is really, it's hard for people to get on with their lives. I just literally, also, I don't know if you guys heard, I think it was yesterday, there was a suicide bombing that injured some Canadian soldiers who were distributing candy to kids. This was about 10 miles outside of Kandahar. It's in a village where the family land of one of my cooperative members is located and where one of our rose plots is located, in that village. So I... thank goodness, email, you know, is everybody okay? Is Abdelahad's family okay? Were any of the kids in his family injured in this thing? And I, this morning, thank God, got an email back saying, no, he brought all of the family is now in, he lives in Kandahar proper. It's his older brother who is living on their land. But the older brother and his entire family and all of their relatives are now into Kandahar because it's not safe anymore in that village, which is 10 miles outside of town. And that's, you know, it's hard. I actually asked the women at Argonne if they wanted to have literacy training. They don't read. And so I said, would you like it if I brought a teacher in here once a week? And they, I have to say, almost said, I mean, they were polite because I'm their boss and stuff, so they didn't say, God, no. But it was pretty clear to me that one more thing, we can't take it on. I just, you know, I don't want to take this on right now. In Kabul and in the north, the situation is much better. So I'm really giving you the worst of things. But in Kabul, I've seen the burqa is definitely receding in Kabul. Every time I go up there, I see fewer people wearing it. So it's not a monolithically horrific picture.
Sarah, this is a challenging question.
Okay.
We have, unfortunately, time for only a few moments more. But would you... this is a comment from someone who feels that the media has been ignoring the realities in Afghanistan that you describe. What is your explanation for it?
I think my explanation for the problem with the media's focus has to do with continuity. This is the other, you know, kind of subliminal message I'm trying to pass along, is that you can't figure something out when you're on a two-week rotation or a one-month rotation. And I was starting to feel this way even before 9/11 and going to Afghanistan. You know, I'm working for NPR, and I'm basically being parachuted into very complex, usually post-conflict situations, and I happen to operate in such a way that I can't think properly unless I feel. And I don't know if that's a personal idiosyncrasy or if most human beings are like that, but I need to open my heart in order to have my brain function properly. And you can't do that when you're spending 2 weeks in Afghanistan, and then you're going to do a special program on slavery in Sudan, and then you're going, you know. So there's that. And unfortunately, it has to do with where, for whatever reason, where we're putting our resources as a society. I mean, I was on a panel with the foreign editor of the Boston Globe, and the guy looked, I hate to say it, but the guy looked dog-whipped. I mean, he is closing bureaus. He is having to lay off foreign correspondents in this day and age. And, I just think there aren't enough people to go around. The Washington Post is laying off 70 seasoned reporters right now, among them a number of foreign correspondents. So how are we supposed to find out more about the world when we're getting it from fewer and fewer sources? And unfortunately, what's moving into the vacuum is either syndicated news bites, which are not sufficiently complex to be able to pass along the word, or blogs. And I'm all in favor of blogs, but it's often unchecked. I don't even want to call it information, because it's what people think is going on. You know, when you read a blog, you need to really know a lot about the person who's writing it to know whether you can trust their version of events. And that, in my view, is the job of journalists, is to take competing and variously accurate or variously reliable sources of information and sift them and provide the public with what in the journalist's and the editor's professional opinion is the closest to the truth. And that doesn't mean necessarily what's exactly in the middle. I think there's a kind of shortcut that we take that says, oh, if we give, you know, this side 2 minutes and that side 2 minutes, we've done our job. I disagree with that. I think that it's our professional duty to actually try to figure out where does the truth lie. You know, and to provide the public with our reasoning for coming to that conclusion. But I think it also has to do with continuity and taking the time to get to know the people who are the story.
Well, thank you very much. Our thanks to Sarah Chase, former NPR correspondent and author of The Punishment of Virtue. And we thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Dr. Gail Lapidus, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.